Great to have you with us on WPR News, Larry Mueller. And today we begin the show by talking about our first book club book selection of the year. It's a novel, and its title is The Snowbirds. And really pleased to have the author with us today, Christina Clancy. She's also a former English professor. She taught at Beloit College. Christina has a PhD in creative writing from UW-Milwaukee. And she has some other books as well. Her works include Shoulder Season and another, The Second Home. And, of course, her latest is The Snowbirds. She splits her time between Madison and Palm Springs. Two pretty good places, I think, to split your time. Well, we'll find out about that as we talk with her. And as we do talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Did you have time to read the book? It's just recently released. If you did, I hope you'll join in with your thoughts and comments. And also, let's talk about travel. Well, tell us where you love to travel when Wisconsin winter gets cold. And this book is about relationships. So maybe you could talk about what's kept you and your partner together all these years. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Christina Clancy, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the program. I'm a listener, and I've learned so much from you over the years about birds and bikes and books and bugs and gardening. So thanks. It's an honor to be on.
Well, and your book's just out. I mean, it's a month or less.
Not even. It's been, about 3 weeks. It hit the USA Today bestseller list 2 weeks in a row, which is really exciting. So we're off and running.
Well, I enjoyed the book. And for those who, obviously, lots of people listening today have not had a chance to read the book. So maybe start by giving us a brief description of what The Snowbirds is about.
Sure. Well, it's actually about a pair of snowbirds. And for those who you had mentioned in the intro that snowbirds are people who spend their winter somewhere else and some are warmer. This is about a couple, Grant and Kim. They have never been married, even though they've been together for 30 years. And they've reached kind of a point in their relationship. Their kids are grown. Grant has recently lost his job at the small liberal arts college that just closed, like Northland College that they just announced.
Yeah.
And then Kim has a work sabbatical from her job. She wants to go somewhere warm. She does not like winter. Grant doesn't mind it at all. And so they decide to go to Palm Springs for the winter as a compromise. And Kim's ex-husband, Basil, is gay, and he has this fabulous condo that he's offered them to use. And they get to Palm Springs. And when they're there, they meet a number of different people who give them a kaleidoscopic view of their relationship. And they're working on themselves, trying to figure out their own identities, their own futures. And also they're trying to decide if they should stay together. They get into an argument. And one day, Grant, who is tend to have emotional walkabouts when he gets upset, decides to go for a solo hike, and he doesn't return. And they've just had an argument, and Kim isn't sure if he's left her or if he might truly be lost on a hike. And the more she learns about what happens to missing hikers, the scarier that option becomes.
I loved how you've organized the book, because we've got some high adventure here going on throughout the book. And so we get a chapter, maybe two, of that kind of what's going on. But then you use the rest of the time wisely to talk about their relationship together over the years.
Yeah, it was hard. I wanted originally to just have the story move forward and have it be a missing hiker adventure and see how to do that. But when you're working on a story about a couple that's been together for a long time, you realize that you just can't move forward without going backwards and exploring what's happened in their past and what sort of like wounds they've suffered and scars they have and the joys and delights and what their meet cute was. So I just decided to intersperse some of the chapters with their background.
I love that aspect of the book, as a matter of fact. And you've picked out an excerpt that you would be willing to read for us. And I saw what you picked ahead of time, so I know what's coming, but please go ahead.
Oh, sure. Well, this is Kim is trying to convince Grant to go to Palm Springs, and he's not really sure about it. So it starts out with Kim saying to Grant, "We can live in the same city, the same house even. We can be a normal couple. We can finally be us." But that was the problem. I wasn't sure what us meant after spending so much time apart. "We'll be together all winter, Grant. I think this adventure is going to be amazing." "Does this really qualify as an adventure?" he asked. "It's fairly conventional to spend a winter away. If you can afford it, that is. We pretty much know exactly what to expect. Sun, palm trees, a pool, old people in golf carts. Warmth. The cold reminds you that you're alive. So did my broken ankle from slipping on ice." He said, "Isn't it shallow to want to go somewhere just because of the weather?" "Shallow?" I groaned. "I'm tired of shoveling and scraping ice off the windshield with a credit card. The wind feels like rocks in my face." "I like the cold. I mean, I don't just like it. I love it. My spirit animal is a Siberian husky." "My spirit animal is a lizard basking in the sun." We just left home and already I felt an argument coming on. "Grant, I hate winter. I mean, I really, really hate it. Doesn't it matter to you that all these years I've been miserable?" Hadn't he seen me walking around the house in my fuzzy wearable blanket? Hadn't he seen my face lit up by a happy lamp in the depths of February? You know what? I was feeling more passionate about the subject than ever. "I'd be fine if I never saw another snowflake for the rest of my life." I tried to put a positive lilt in my voice so we wouldn't fight. "Maybe you'll discover that you like escaping the cold. Look at all the celebrities who go to Palm Springs. Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt." "Ooh, Brad Pitt, whoop-de-doo." "I'm just saying, and I'm just saying that I don't know why you're making me go to the desert. You could have stayed back. It was your choice to say no. Not if I wanted to be with you."
Yeah. And that was a great, great piece to select. It does highlight many of the discussions that they had over time, and they were quite realistic. I mean, the conversation between couples.
Yeah, I kind of wondered what happens with couples when one person doesn't like the cold and the other one does. You know, it's a kind of fundamental disagreement. And when Grant asks, "Isn't it shallow to choose weather?" I started to wonder, is it shallow? You know, I think as your life becomes more free, when your kids are grown and you can choose to be somewhere else and you have that option, if you feel like you'd be a different person in warm weather and you'd be happier in warm weather, what happens to a relationship when there's no agreement there?
Yeah. Well, it was really realistic, your conversations. And I wondered at the time, well, I remember right in the start of the book, you have a very lovely shout out to your spouse, your partner.
Oh, and right. Yeah.
So you guys get along.
We do. My husband's great. And in fact, I say in the acknowledgments that I thank him for making the book so difficult for me to write, because my husband is a very, very agreeable person. He's just lovely and really sweet. And, you know, but stories are made up and literature comes from trouble. So I spent, when I was first working on the book, I spent a lot of time trying to find couples that had lots of issues that were different, but I didn't want to have an affair. I just felt like there've been so many stories about affairs. So I was trying to think, well, what sorts of issues do other couples have? So I landed on this idea of this couple that spent a lot of time doing separate things, because it just kind of accentuates what happens in life when you're so busy with your regular life. You're doing things, you're raising your kids, you're busy with your work. And then suddenly, whether you're asking for it or not, your life totally changes and you look around and you realize that you can make a whole different set of decisions.
Yeah, very interesting. Kim, you know, as you say, they're not married. Grant wants to get hitched. Mm-hmm. And but Kim isn't sure what's going on in her head.
Well, Kim is someone who's very independent. She was raised by someone who really valued independence over dependency on people. Her own parents had had a very unconventional relationship. Her dad had owned a campground in northern Wisconsin, and her mom lived in Chicago, and she didn't want to spend the whole winter there. So that's kind of baked into Kim's personality. And Kim is kind of afraid to rely on Grant because he has a history of being a little bit unreliable, and it's hurt her very much, even though in the times he's kind of taken off, it's never been for too long. It's left a really lasting impression on her to the point where she's not sure as she gets older, can she count on Grant to be the person to take care of her in her old age? And does she want to be the person to take care of him?
Yeah. And what I found interesting along with the relationship between the two of them were the exes. Basil and mm-hmm. Sasha, and the role that they talk about the role that they play in their lives.
Yeah, I kind of wanted each of the characters to have a wingman, you know, someone who they offload all of their emotions onto, so that they don't have to lean on each other. So for a lot of Kim's life, she's her very best friend growing up, and the person she married is Basil, and he, you know, she just calls him whenever she has any kinds of problems or issues, and she tells him all of her deepest secrets instead of telling her own husband. And, you know, Basil's, you know, in a relationship with someone else and running around all over the world. And then Grant has an ex, Sasha, who he has a very intellectual relationship with. They're both academics. They worked on a book together. As he says, they had a sapiosexual relationship, which is like a relationship of the mind. And so Kim feels kind of excluded from that relationship. So, you know, I think other people do enter our relationships in different ways. Our friends do. And I just kind of wanted to call that out in a kind of extreme way with this couple who's really struggling to learn to lean into each other.
Yeah. And Sasha got granted the job at the college where he was teaching at, which we should say is, you know, far enough away that he had to be gone all week while Kim raised their two children.
Right. And I found that when I was an academic that people, you know, if you work at a college that's a ways away from a metropolitan area, a lot of times couples do live in separate cities. And so I just thought that was very realistic to write about an academic who, you know, spends a lot of time there. And ironically, when he and Sasha were married, she never changes her name back. So they work at the college together and they both have the last name Duffy. So everybody there thinks that Grant and Sasha are married. And, you know, and then I kind of wanted to leave it up to the reader to wonder, like, what really goes on with Sasha and Grant.
Yeah. Christina Clancy, our guest today. Her interesting novel is The Snowbirds. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts, questions, or comments as we move along today. How has your relationship survived 30 years? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. We're talking with Christina Clancy. She is the author of the book The Snowbirds, a novel, and it's a fun read. As she has Kim and Grant, who aren't married, but they've been together and they have for a long, long time, and they have twins, daughters. And they have a chance to move to Palm Springs for, I think it was something like 6 months, something like that. It's sort of the story of their relationship and kind of what happens to them in Palm Springs. And by the way, I'm sort of counting up in my head the number of people who have actually play sort of a major role, and I think I counted 14. And what I was really pleased about was the fact that the way you write them in and the conversations, it was easy for me to keep track of who was who.
Oh, yeah. It's an art when you're working on a book, because sometimes you feel like you need one of those family diagrams, you know, in order to keep track of everyone. So yeah, I tried to lace them in slowly. And I actually love reading a book where you're reading along and suddenly a new character comes in and it just kind of changes the dynamic of the book.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of those characters in this book as we move along today. But Kim's the narrator, I guess you could say, of the book for the most part, most of the time. And you get, let me say, total insight into the way she thinks. And at times, she can be a little frustrating. You know, she's definitely not perfect.
You know, I think most all my characters in all my books are imperfect. You know, I know a lot of writers try to appeal to readers by having characters who are super likable. And I want my characters to be likable, but more than that, I want them to be relatable. And the kinds of people that I find relatable and interesting are kind of messy and complicated. And the other thing that was hard when I was working on the book is I realized, you know, when you know a lot of couples, you might hear one person's side of an argument. And the more I was working on the book, I thought, if I'm telling the story from Kim's perspective, I bet Kim has some issues too that Grant could take issue with. And he doesn't get as much of a voice in it, but I needed to show that she's fallible. She's made mistakes over the years. And so I had to make her do some things that, you know, the reader might disapprove of or find frustrating.
Well, there was a time or two in the book where Grant revealed something to her that she hadn't known in all their relationship. And so she was trying to suss out in her mind why he would not have brought that up. And she three or four things come to mind. And I'm thinking, no, you missed the main one. I think he would have thought this way. Oh, man. Well, this whole this business, a theme throughout Kim and Grant's relationship is forgiveness. Why is that important in a long-lasting relationship?
Oh, I think you can nurture grudges in a long relationship. And, you know, and I think it's sort of a beautiful thing when you write fiction, because you always need a character to have an arc, right? Like, you need your characters to change. And the more I work on fiction, the more I realize that people change. People in my life, in real life, not in fiction.
Yeah.
They change. They're capable of change. They can do really dumb things. And I thought about that a lot, especially with my second book, Shoulder Season, which is about a former Playboy bunny who worked at the old Playboy resort in Lake Geneva. And the whole project of that book was to write about somebody who looks back on a time in her life when she'd done a lot of dumb things. And I thought, what's it like when you're 60 to look back on the dumb things you did when you were 19 years old? Do you forgive yourself? So I hadn't thought about this until you mentioned it, but I probably carried over some of that theme into the Snowbirds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are several other couples in the novel. There's an older couple I kind of liked, Jean and Jeannie.
Denim and DNA.
And I also like Basil's mother, Melody, as well, as she often reflected on her late husband. What do these relationships teach? Let's put it this way. What do they teach Grant and Kim?
I think, you know, we see ourselves reflected in other people, and we see how other people see us, and it's always informative. And so you know, I said earlier that I used that word kaleidoscopic view of their relationship. And I think each of those characters help, you know, Jean and Jeannie have a really great relationship. They've been together a long time. They're facing troubles, but they're together. They're doing it together. They also have this wonderful attitude about life, you know, where Jean says to Kim, you know, you don't know how many winters you have, you know, just be happy and enjoy the person you're with. And I think that's something that she needs to hear at that time. She's very receptive to that. And then also Melody is her ex-mother-in-law. And I have a wonderful mother-in-law, and I think it's really interesting to get to know your partner through the people who love them. And so it's really nice to have Melody's just one of those characters that I don't know where she came from, but as soon as she started speaking in my book, it was like she was just singing out of my head. Like, she was so fun and easy to write. I thought actually about revising the whole book and having it be from her perspective because I liked her so much. But she also, one thing that's great about Melody is she encourages Kim to think about this as a time in her life when she can reinvent herself, which a lot of people, when they reach middle age, you know, this is a really big theme in the book. Kim is, you know, is wondering, I'm middle age, like, do I have to keep struggling and trying? You know, at any point in my life, can I just relax and settle and be? And I think she finds out, no, you really, like, the better option is to just continue to expand and grow and embrace new challenges. And Melody is a really great mouthpiece for that.
Yeah. And Melody's living at Smoke Tree Ranch, which is an actual ranch. Is it?
Yeah, it's actually, it's funny. The day my book came out, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about the most like secretive, wealthy enclave that nobody really knows about. And it's Smoke Tree Ranch. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, I wrote about that. You can go there in my book. But yeah, Smoke Tree Ranch is this massive property. It's actually like native desert, which is really shocking. You know, it hasn't been developed except for the small portion of it. Walt Disney used to live there. And it was actually founded by Midwesterners, mostly from Michigan, during the Lindbergh kidnapping time. It was all these wealthy people who wanted to make sure that their kids would be safe when they were on vacation. So that's the property is very secluded and always has been. And it's really rarefied. And the thing I love about it is it, you know, when people think of Palm Springs, they think of caftans and Aperol spritzes by the pool and Frank Sinatra and mid-century modern architecture. But a part of Palm Springs that I love to explore and that's very present in the part of Palm Springs where we live is more like old Palm Springs with the Spanish colonial architecture and places like Smoke Tree. And I just love the nostalgia of Palm Springs past.
Christina Clancy, our guest today, her book is The Snowbirds. Great to have her with us. And you can join in if you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share about your own relationship and how you've survived together as a partnership. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. You know, another character that I really found interesting was Cassie.
Oh.
talk about her and how you created her life philosophy. I think Clara Neipert, our producer for today, really liked her as well.
Oh, she's fun. She's really young, and she's a shaman. But as Kim notices, she looks like she could work at Lululemon, so she doesn't defy everyone's. She defies everyone's expectations. She's very beautiful and engaging, and she, you know, I loved writing her character because a lot of times when, as a Midwesterner myself, going to Palm Springs. There's a lot of things about Palm Springs that are different than what we experience in the Midwest. And first of all, we started going to sound baths, I'm starting to see sound baths in Madison, but in the desert, it's a really big deal. And there's a lot of alternative spirituality. And I wanted to introduce that in a respectful way, because when you meet people who are very spiritual in ways that might be different than we are, they're so sincere about it. And so I actually met a shaman and became friends with her, and she helped me research the role of Cassie. And I thought it was really, you know, Kim and Grant are having problems, and so they needed an intermediary. And you could have a therapist, you could have a priest, you could have a rabbi, you could have somebody else who you would expect, but to have a shaman walk in and talk about Grant being an energy vampire, you know, it just was pretty fun to write about.
So describe people. Some people are saying, well, what was that again? Sound baths?
Sound baths are where you lie down and, you know, a bath sounds relaxing, right? Mm-hmm. Like you think, oh, it's going to be so mellow. I'm just going to lie down and I'm lying down. But you lie down and they have these bowls that they run a mallet over the rims of the mallet of the bowls. And it's so loud that it feels literally kind of like a sound blade that runs through you. And the whole goal is to like jiggle your cells, you know, as you're listening. And we went to this place. I also wrote about it in the book. And if listeners Google it, it's called the Integratron. And it's out near Joshua Tree. It's this structure that's dome-like, and it was built actually with the help of Howard Hughes. He helped get the redwoods from the Pacific Northwest to build this dome. It's acoustically perfect. There are no nails. There's no metal on the inside of it. So it was originally like a spaceship. It was supposed to turn backwards and communicate with the Venusians from Venus. And and then the guy who started it died. And so the family has taken it over and now they have sound baths. And it really is a remarkable place to go. If you are planning a trip to Palm Springs, you have to book it months in advance. They sell out. And for 30, 45 minutes, you lie down and they'll play different bowls that are supposed to do different things to your chakras. And it's a pretty phenomenal experience. I definitely recommend it.
And it appears in the book.
Yes. Yes. Kim and Grant have a moment in the sound bath.
Dennis in Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance to join in. Dennis, thanks for calling.
Well, I'm calling about something that was brought up before, but as far as sound bath, it would also seem like it would be something that would be like a massage, too, because of the vibrations. But I was calling because of what you were talking about with grudges and people changing, is it seems when somebody has a grudge, whether it's against family members or whatever, they could have a political grudge, but then they just hold on to that and they don't adjust to reality as it changes, whether it's with the relationships that are close to them or how people change in society.
Hmm. Dennis, thanks for calling. Comments, Christina?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that it's something has to change in order to let go of a grudge. So whether it's having a sound bath, jiggle your cells to change that, or a conversation that you might have with somebody that has to be forced, you know, that can help. So that was what's helpful with the book, is to move the plot along and have the characters face obstacles that force them to change and address each other.
If you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. An emailer wonders, how much backstory do you create for your characters, and how much actually gets in the book?
I love that question. You know, when I teach, one of the things I always tell my students is that your first draft you write for yourself, and then the second draft and beyond is for your readers. So sometimes in your first draft, you'll have a lot of backstory that you need so that you can get to know your characters and you can understand them. But then as you revise, you realize your character or your readers don't necessarily need all the backstory. They don't need to know everything. But you can kind of like skim off the top and give them just what they need to keep the story moving. So with this book, I did a lot of pre-writing where I would write backgrounds of the story. There's so much that's not in the book that's in my head where I just needed to know. And that's also a great thing about having a wonderful editor. You know, she was really helpful saying, you know, the reader really doesn't need to know this. And you know, for anyone who's an aspiring writer, like one thing that one of my former professors used to say is trust your reader. And I thought that was such great advice, because readers are smart and you don't necessarily need to be ham-fisted and force everything down. They can deal with nuance and you don't have to share everything.
Grant, to me, was a character who's very distinct views about the world as a philosophy professor. Was it easy to build, or maybe I should say, how did you build this character?
Well, I wanted Grant to be somebody who was so absorbed in the life of the mind that he kind of can't be in a relationship in a very productive way, because he's so caught up in his thoughts and his ideas that he's just not really in the physical world with his partner. So I needed to get Grant, like hiking was a great way to get Grant out of his head and into the wild. It's kind of like teaching a baby to swim by throwing him into a pool, you know? So, yeah, he can be really frustrating. But I really like Grant. I know that, you know, everyone has their flaws.
Well, I have to say I liked him better than I liked Kim.
Oh, that's interesting. Kim, I wanted to make kind of a character who was really normal. I wanted her to not have too many quirks. I wanted her to be somebody that almost anyone could read. Like, she's kind of like a vessel where I wanted people to be able to relate to most of the way she would see the world.
You know, you have a PhD in creative writing from UW-Milwaukee, and you taught English at Beloit College. I imagine those experiences helped you craft Grant's character and the world of academia in which he lives.
Right. And I was actually worried people would think it's Beloit College that I'm writing about. And at first it kind of was, just like with characters, you base a character sometimes off like a sketch of somebody that you know, but then they start taking on their own shape. But I think from Grant's perspective, when I was working at Beloit College, they were dealing with a lot of budget issues. And I just started being fascinated with the idea of like, what if this place closed? And it made me so sad to think of just the wonderful students and all the energy that faculty put into teaching them. And I feel like that carries over into the book. And I wanted Grant, you know, he's grieving the fact that he's lost, that the college he worked at actually did close. And so he's kind of petulant and hard to deal with, but at the same time, he's a sad person. You know, he's lost a you know, part of his identity is being a teacher. So I feel like Kim she's tolerant of that, but she, you know, and she's sympathetic, but at the same time, she also just kind of needs him to be there with her.
Yeah. Well, as when I was reading it, at first I thought, oh, he's probably Beloit College because I knew you'd taught there. But then I thought, no, the place sounds more, the community sounds more like Ripon College.
Oh, yeah. It could be anywhere. I imagined it in central Wisconsin. And I'm pretty proud of the name I came up with for it. I don't know if you remember College of the Mounds.
Yeah.
I laughed.
How did you come up with that?
I don't know, but it just came up and I just started laughing and I was like, oh, that is a good name for a college.
Well, I thought, well, that the community itself reminded me more of like Ripon College. And then I thought Northland too. And so then I just realized, well, there's probably little bits of a lot of places.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think that, you know, I think also in Shoulder Season, not to keep bringing up Shoulder Season, but that's also about small towns. And I love the town of East Troy, Wisconsin. And I wanted to kind of redeem life in small towns. It's so meaningful there. And I think there's this tension, not just between Madison and Palm Springs, but Kim and Grant have always had a tension in their relationship between living in Madison or moving to the small town where Grant teaches. And Kim's quick to disparage it, but Grant loves it. And Kim just needs to learn to find to love what he loves.
And they do a lot of work on themselves during the course of the story, I think. How do you see them, or how do we see them, the reader sees them evolve as individuals?
Well, I think the work they do on themselves is kind of coaxed out of them by the people that they meet who test their boundaries and make them see life a little differently. They have them explore, you know, for Kim, she wants to have fun. So she meets this wonderful couple, Thomas and Raul, who live in the quirky condo complex, and they get her to go to their morning workout classes. And in Palm Springs, I go to a morning workout class in Ruth Hardy Park, and people wear tutus and outfits. And it's just like Richard Simmons, and they play disco music, and you like do Hakuna Matata at the sun staring at the mountains. And it's just like something you wouldn't necessarily see, this open expression of joy and the beauty of being outdoors in Palm Springs in February. So I think the weather too helps Kim, you know, become more loose and relaxed because she likes being in the warmth. And then the Grant also, you know, Kim starts seeing that Grant is actually really great with people. And she appreciates his openness to meeting new people and how he kind of takes on Gene, the older man, and he takes them to like the air show or, the, you know, the air museum and he takes them grocery shopping. And she starts seeing that Grant's a good guy. You know, he does good things. So I think that's part of how they change is by leaning into the community that they've found.
Yeah. And it was a fun part of it for me. And, you know, I was thinking about how does a person's personality change when you go? I mean, let's say you've got this home, and in this case, for them, it was Madison. Mm-hmm. Now you're in Palm Springs where you don't really know anybody, but you make friends. But does it cause a person's personality to change as they move in that kind of a way, do you think?
Well, I think so, based on the time we spend in Palm Springs. But I think what I'm most moved by and struck by profoundly is, you know, the word snowbird is really laden, right? You know, there's a line in the book where Kim and Grant arrive and they overhear someone say, oh God, the snowbirds are here. Now there's going to be a line for prescriptions at the Walgreens, you know? But the people that are snowbirds are really, really close. You know, if you go to the same condo complex every year, year after year, and you aren't working and you have time for each other and you have time for friends, you can develop some of the most intense, meaningful relationships of your life with the other people who are around you. And with the first year we were snowbirds, the Canadians couldn't come because it was COVID. And everyone in our condo complex missed the Canadians so much. And then the next year, while I was working on the book, the Canadians were back and they were so happy to be back. And I was struck by how profoundly impacted their lives were by each other. They're there for, you know, when you get older, you know, things happen. Your own health might suffer. Your partner's health might suffer. Your friends might need help. Their kids might have issues and they are part of all of it. And so even though they're temporary residents, they might feel more rooted and at home in the place where they snowbird than they do even where they live, because where you live, you get busy and you get into your routines.
As you were talking, I was thinking about even in short-term situations, this can happen. Now, I've had season football tickets for the Badgers for years and years and years. I sit in the same two chairs. I've got whoever I bring along with me, usually my daughter. And I see the people behind me and the people right in front of me and the people on either side of me. And it's just, and they're friends, even though I never see them. And it would be hard to give up the tickets for the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really fascinating. Sharon and DePere, you have something for us. Hi.
Larry, I'm a librarian, so I love when you talk to authors, and I'm looking forward to reading this book, newly came out. I'm actually on my way to work, so I got to see if we have it. And I'm curious who some of the author's favorite contemporary authors she likes to read are.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I love that question. It's so funny. Sometimes, even though I read all the time and people ask me for favorite authors, it's like when someone says, tell me a joke. <you're> like, I've been reading so much lately. I just read Colored Television by Donza Sanna. Is that she's married to Percival Everett, who wrote James. I thought that was a wonderful story. I read Martyr, which I really loved. I thought that was terrific. I love the writer. She's a Canadian writer named Miriam Tebbs, and Daniel Golden at Boswell Books put her book, All My Puny Sorrows, in my hand when I walked through the store into the store one day. And he said, just don't even read about this. Just read it. Trust me. Which is like the great thing about knowing librarians and booksellers, right? Like they know you and what you'll like. And All My Puny Sorrows is one of my favorite books. And I love Miriam Tebbs. You spell it T-O-E-W-S is her name. My friend Sarah Sliger has a wonderful book that just came out called Vantage Point. Linda Cohen-Leugman is a friend of mine. She wrote a book called The Love Elixir of Augusta Stern that I really enjoy. My friend Maggie Ginsburg has a book called Still True that came out, and everyone who I talk to who's read that book, including myself, just goes crazy for it. It's with the University of Wisconsin Press. So those are some that just sprung into my mind. And as soon as we hang up, I know I'm going to wish I'd mentioned other ones.
Sharon, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to one thing we haven't covered, really, which kind of plays a big role in the book, is hiking. Mm-hmm. And Grant goes on a hike near Palm Springs and gets lost. But he becomes, it's one thing that really grabs his attention and something that he really gets into when they get to Palm Springs.
Yeah, well, I am an avid hiker. And I would go out during COVID and I'd hike for miles and miles. And all of a sudden I'd look around and realized I hadn't seen anyone in an hour or two. And I'd wonder, am I a stupid tourist out here? Am I risking my life? And I don't even realize it. And so I started learning about, I would Google missing hiker Palm Springs. And I became kind of obsessed with all those stories. And I think our culture has kind of a collective fascination with lost hiker stories too. They just are so interesting to think that somebody could go on a hike and maybe never, ever be found again, that that's the last you ever see or hear from them. And the idea of getting lost, I think, is also really fascinating. And then when we bought our condo, I met these friends, Gord and Roger, and they had gone for a hike, I think in 2018, and only Gord came back. And Roger was in his 70s. He was missing for 3 days. And everyone assumed that he was not alive. And when they were telling me the story about it, they found him, thank goodness, just in the nick of time. But I was really interested not so much in what happened to Roger when he was hiking, but in what it must have been like for his wife, Sheila, and for Gord to come back from that hike and wait for updates from the rescue people. And I always wonder that when I hear about anyone going missing. And so I was able to chat with them a lot about it and hear about how our condo complex came together to unite around Roger's search. And I find it really life-affirming to know that when someone is missing on a hike, that such a massive effort is undertaken. It's expensive. It's resource intensive. They need a lot of technology. People risk their lives to try to find someone who's missing. And I think that's one of the best, like most human things in the world, is to care about someone when they're gone and to help a total stranger find their way home.
Yeah. Christina Clancy, our guest. Her novel is The Snowbirds. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Christina Clancy. She is the author of the novel The Snowbirds, and having a great time talking with her about the book. Questions, comments, experience, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. That hiking part of it really got to me. I like to hike. And I have not hiked in California, but I have hiked in Arizona. The Saguaro National Park near Tucson. And, boy, it gets drummed into your head. Do not go off the paths. And all of the care that you should be taking once, just for fun, I walked off a path. But I kept a saguaro, a particular one, in right next to the path when I walked off, and I turned around and I took about 50 steps off, and I turned around, and if I hadn't known that saguaro, I could not see the path. I mean, it's so easy to get screwed up.
Yeah, it's easy. And also when you're hiking, especially in Palm Springs, I was actually just doing an event yesterday in La Jolla. And one of the people at the event said she'd gone hiking, a 2 mile hike in Palm Springs. And she said there were two paths that diverged, and she didn't even go off the path. She just took a different one and she got turned around. And there's this moment when you realize you're really and truly lost. And it's a physiological phenomenon. Like your whole body changes with that kind of fear. And I think we don't think enough about orientation, you know, and how important that is in our brains. You know, it's just reading that taxi drivers and ambulance drivers have the lowest incidence of Alzheimer's. And they think that's because they're finding their way around. But because of GPS, we're used to knowing where we are because of that blue dot on our phone. But it's really helpful. And also a lot of the research I did said children should learn how to get lost. You know, that it's a skill that they don't learn because we're always so careful with kids.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've read some research. I think there was some research done on London cab drivers who the part of their brain was much larger than normal because they had learned. I mean, that part of the brain that would tell you the streets and how to get from here to there was much enlarged.
Yeah, so, I try not to use GPS as much now. I still do sometimes, but I try not to rely on it as much as I would. I really try to think, well, where was I? What were my visual landmarks?
Yeah. These settings, Madison and Palm Springs, they're such an important part of the novel. And a place can mean so many different things to different people. How do you did such a nice job of capturing the layers of Madison, for example, which I have spent many a year in. How do you capture the layers of a city in your writing?
You know, that's so interesting. I'm definitely a writer of place. Until I know where my book is set, I can't start writing because place becomes like another character. And you know, it was fun writing Palm Springs because I wasn't an expert on Palm Springs the way people who have been there their whole lives and have family and for generations in Palm Springs, but I could write about what it's like to go there as a snowbird. And I think for myself, I could capture Madison because I had spent time away from Madison, and being gone made me appreciate it. And it made me see it from a different vantage than I was used to. So I think the culture of Madison, you know, it's funny. I worry people are going to think I'm stereotyping the characters because they have like all the bumper stickers you would expect Madisonians to have on their car. And they're pretty liberal, and they have like different opinions about like liberal arts colleges versus UW. And, but that's just very much what I experience when I'm there. And one thing that, I thought earlier about having characters from a more conservative place and have them be more uptight so that going to Palm Springs would be more jarring for them. But what was great about writing about people from Madison is that it would still be different culturally and socially, but they'd be very open to a place like Palm Springs. So it helped usher in the changes that I wanted the characters to undergo a little faster.
Where did you do most of your writing for the book? Was it in Wisconsin or California?
We have a little cottage on Lake Beulah in East Troy.
Ah.
And we have a sun porch. And almost all my books, I'd say 80% of all my books are written in that room. I don't know what it is about the light and the peace and calm that I feel. And I did do some writing in Palm Springs also, especially for this book. But this is the first book I've spent a lot of time writing in Palm Springs. But I'd go on an adventure, I'd learn something, and then I'd just open up my laptop and start writing. You know, it just kind of fed the story.
I love the little asides about the people, the real people who had lived there and so forth. That was really a fun part of the book, for a little aside, but a fun part of the book for me, sure.
It was fun for me to write.
And I know your other book, The Second Home, is going to become a TV series?
Well, I mean, who knows? They say in Hollywood, they overpromise and underdeliver, and in publishing, they underpromise and overdeliver. So I don't know if that's true. But yeah, it was originally optioned by Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who played Jamie Lannister in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And he's quite a hunk. And he wanted to play the character Anthony. And then during the writer's strike, all the people at Sony TriStar who they would normally work on the option with had left. And so right now there's a screenwriting team in Los Angeles who have optioned it, and they want to turn it into a feature film instead of a TV series. So that's in the works. And who knows?
Yeah, and maybe The Snowbirds will eventually turn into a movie. Who knows?
Yeah, or a series. Maybe every season they'll be in a different place.
Christina Clancy, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate your time and really enjoyed the book. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, you're a pro. Thank you so much, Larry. I'm just so honored to be on your show.
Christina Clancy's book, The Snowbirds. Thank you for listening. I'm Larry Mealer.